From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Midterm tidal wave. Mitch McConnell and the GOP take the Senate.
It's time to turn this country around.
President Obama says he got the message.
As president, I have a unique responsibility to try and make this town work. So to everyone who voted, I want you to know that I hear you.
Texas is officially Ebola-free. Governor-elect Greg Abbott.
We will remain vigilant and on guard in the state of Texas, constantly working to ensure that hospital and medical personnel in this state will be prepared to deal with it if it ever comes back.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes from CBS News, McKay Coppins from BuzzFeed, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What's your reaction to the midterm election results? Was this a referendum on President Obama? What other stories are you watching this week? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from Bowling Green, Kentucky, is McKay Coppins, senior political writer for BuzzFeed News. McKay, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me on, Jane.
And joining us from Washington, Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Jane. Great to be here.
And joining us, as always, from New York, Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, McKay, and Nancy.
So we'll start with the Republican landslide in the midterm election this week. You've had a few days to catch up on some sleep. Nancy Cordes, put this week into context for us. What happened?
Well, I think Democrats and Republicans would agree that in the final weeks of this campaign, the momentum really shifted towards the Republicans, and a bunch of races that we thought were going to be toss-ups and really tight races ended up being real landslides for Republicans. Not only did they win almost all of the battleground races, but they won huge. They won by 18 points in Arkansas, by 8 points in Iowa, by 8 points in Georgia. They come in with a larger majority than many analysts expected, and they come in with a bit of swagger, saying that not only did the people in these battleground states vote for their candidate, but that they gave them a mandate to govern as Republicans want to.
McKay Coppins, the party not in power often takes back control during a second-term presidency, but was it expected to the degree we saw this week?
I think if you talk to Republicans, they would say that this was an even better outcome than they were expecting. I mean, we have to remember that this was a fairly favorable map for Republicans. Just the way that the various elections worked out, the races, the states that had Senate races tended to be more red states where Republicans were more competitive. That said, they really seized the opportunity and took advantage of it. There's a lot of talk about the traditional six-year itch with a president and how that party ends up doing worse around the six-year mark. That said, I think Republicans, rightfully so, can claim that the country is tired of a lot of Obama's policies and that they want a fresh start. That said, I don't, Republicans also have a not very great brand nationally, and they're going to have to show the country that they can govern and actually get things done in Washington.
On Wednesday, President Obama gave a press release responding to the big Republican wins in the midterm elections.
To everyone who voted, I want you to know that I hear you. To the two-thirds of voters who chose not to participate in the process yesterday, I hear you too. All of us have to give more Americans a reason to feel like the ground is stable beneath their feet, that the future is secure.
Jack Beatty, what was this midterm election about to your mind? Just a simple referendum on an unpopular president?
Well, the president said he won't read the tea leaves, but I want to read one big one. And it says, this tea leaf does, it's the economy, stupid. National exit polls showed 45% of respondents cited the economy as their chief concern, way ahead of health care at 25 and miles ahead of foreign policy at 13. In that same poll, 63% said they believe that the U.S. economic system generally favors the wealthy. They are not wrong. According to Emmanuel Saez's research, he's an economist, 95% of the income growth since the recession ended has gone to the wealthiest 1%. The president and his party have not delivered rising living standards to Americans, and Americans sent a message, we want change.
On Wednesday, Republican Senator from Kentucky and presumed Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he hoped to avoid any government shutdowns and wanted to focus on, quote, getting stuff done.
Let me make it clear, there will be no government shutdowns and no default on the national debt. We're going to function. This gridlock and dysfunction can be ended. It can be ended by having a Senate that actually, that actually works.
Nancy Cordes, Senator McConnell has said a lot about bipartisanship since Tuesday night. Do you see a different path forward after this week or just more polarized gridlock?
I think it's possible, but we will just have to wait and see. You know, every time a new party takes power, they always say we are going to be we're going to get a lot done.
Right.
And we're going to make progress for the country. No one ever comes into office saying we're going to try to get as little done as possible. And we hope not to accomplish anything. But, you know, when they actually get into power, it really takes the majority and the minority working together to get things done. When Leader Reid was in office, he had a strategy of trying to protect his vulnerable Senate Democrats from having to take tough votes. And that is something that Republicans argued really bottled up the Senate, caused them to vote on almost nothing, and didn't pay off for his members because they didn't, at the end of the day, have much of a record to run on, not much that they could say they had done over the past couple of years. Democrats say no, it was the minority's fault. It's the fact that they were threatening to filibuster every piece of legislation. It's the fact that they wanted to insert so-called poison pills into every piece of legislation to basically force our members to take a vote on something that would make them look bad. So I think there was a lot of blame to go around, rightfully. And the question is whether the parties will play any more nicely come January. Mm.
McKay Coppins, Senate Leader McConnell will have his own fractious caucus to deal with, won't he?
You will.
Yeah.
This is one of the interesting things. I mean, you have to remember when we hear Senator McConnell talking about a new way forward and getting Washington working again, that he was one of the architects of the Republican strategy since 2008 of trying to block every bill that Democrats brought up, trying to block every policy initiative that President Obama was pursuing. Democrats long made hay out of this, saying that Republicans were obstructionists. But in any case, now that Senator McConnell, if you talk to anybody who knows him, anyone in his inner circle, they'll say, you know, this isn't what he dreamed of doing when he came to Washington. You know, he didn't want to just, block every policy initiative and make sure nothing really came out of Congress. So, you sense that he really does want to pursue a real agenda, get bills passed. That said, his problem might not be with getting the six or so Democrats on board that he'll need to get bills passed. It may be from the right flank of the party. We heard from Senator Ted Cruz even before the election, the week before the election, saying that the number one priority for the Republicans, if they took back the Senate, needed to be to repeal Obamacare in full. Even I was at the election night party with Mitch McConnell. Senator Rand Paul, who had been campaigning with him for a week, was up there too. And in his speech, he actually said, we have to repeal every last vestige of Obamacare. And so, that's not really on the agenda for Senator McConnell, at least from what we've seen. That he and Speaker John Boehner wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal kind of outlining their agenda. Nowhere on that agenda was, repeal all of the Affordable Care Act and cause another massive partisan fight. They really want to get things through and show America that Washington actually can get bills passed in a bipartisan way. It's just unclear whether Senator Ted Cruz and the other kind of Tea Party elements of the Republican Party in Congress are going to let that happen.
Jack, House Leader John Boehner will find his influence strengthened upcoming. Will this new configuration give him more room to maneuver, do you think?
Well, the president conjectured that it would in his press conference, but that really seemed like sophistry. I mean, the, 12 or 13 new members are, if anything, more conservative than the people they replaced. Some of them are extremely conservative. The new congressman from Montana, I'm sorry, I don't have his name right here, but he was quoted as saying in some speech that Hillary Clinton was the Antichrist. So this is a very conservative, and the idea that this makes it easier for the speaker to compromise with the president, that just seems sophistry. It makes it harder.
And Nancy Cordes, to Jack's point, many of John Boehner's new members will be conservatives from deep red districts. They may not be so inclined to go along with some bipartisan Senate compromises.
Exactly. And the speaker already had trouble, for example, trying to forge compromise on an issue like immigration reform. You know, he brought it up in January of this year to his members, kind of gave them a broad outline of what he wanted to do. And they basically forced him to shelve it immediately because there were so many House Republicans who just wanted nothing to do with it. So, yes, in that sense, he is going to have the same struggles as before. On the other hand, he has more power than before because all those bills that House Republicans passed that ended up just, you know, sitting in a dustbin in the Senate now will have new life. They will pass bills that will go to the Senate, which will actually take them up. So, you know, that really raises his influence in Washington because he's the one who can get the bills passed right away. And then if Senator McConnell can scrape together the six or seven Democrats that he needs, then he can pass those bills, too. The challenge for Senator McConnell is going to be that the most moderate members of the Democratic Party in the Senate all got voted out on Tuesday night. So he's going to have to go looking for a new coalition of Democrats to create some kind of common ground.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the big week in news, midterm elections this week, and much more. We're joined this hour by McKay Coppins from BuzzFeed, Nancy Cordes from CBS News, and our own Jack Beatty. Here's President Obama on Wednesday saying that he would take executive action on immigration if Congress refused to act.
Before the end of the year, we're going to take whatever lawful actions that I can take that I believe will improve the functioning of our immigration system, that will allow us to surge additional resources to the border, where I think the vast majority of Americans have the deepest concern.
And here's presumed Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell answering, saying that President Obama acting unilaterally on immigration would be a big mistake.
It's like waving a red flag in front of a bull to say, if you guys don't do what I want, I'm going to do it on my own. And the president's done that on Obamacare. He's done it on immigration and threatening to do it again. I hope he won't do that because I do think it poisons the well for the opportunity to address a very important domestic issue.
And here's Speaker of the House, Republican John Boehner, warning the president not to act unilaterally on immigration or anything else.
I believe that the president continues to act on his own. He is going to poison the well. When you play with matches, you take the risk of burning yourself. And he's going to burn himself if he continues to go down this path.
Big messages there on both sides. Nancy Cordes, what about immigration? What are the most significant policy sticking points between Republicans and Democrats right now?
Well, I asked the speaker about immigration at that press conference yesterday, and I said, you know, your conservative members blocked you from doing anything on immigration. Why shouldn't the president act on his own? And he said, you know, there are a number of reasons why we couldn't act. There were children streaming across the border, a problem of the administration's own making, and a bunch of other things, too. I think, you know, if Republicans don't quickly show that they actually are going to take some action in the House on immigration, that will strengthen the president's hand. They said a year and a half ago that they were going to put together a series of smaller bills, not one big comprehensive package, and we're still waiting to see those bills. Areas of agreement, there are some. The speaker and the majority leader have said that they want to work on comprehensive tax reform. The president says that's something that he would like to do, too. But there are big challenges because what one side views as comprehensive tax reform is not the same as the other. Republicans have as their first priority lowering the corporate tax rate, which they say makes the U.S. very makes it very uncompetitive overseas. And they're not as interested in in changing the independent tax rate, the individual tax rate, while Democrats say any tax reform is going to have to raise revenue for the government. So these are some big differences that they will have to hammer out. To his credit, the Majority Leader McConnell is saying some really great things about how he wants to open up the Senate to amendments once again, give members the chance to offer amendments. He wants to let people vote. So this is something that I think will be welcomed by both sides. A lot of senators who felt like they and their issues were basically sidelined over the last couple of years.
Back to immigration for just a minute, McKay Coppins. To your mind, is the immigration bill that was passed in the Senate last summer now completely dead?
You know, one of the things in Washington over the last year or so has been these constant moments where there's a revival of hope that maybe the House could take up some version of that bill. I never want to say anything is completely dead because you just never know. There are prominent House Republicans like Congressman Paul Ryan, who looks like he's poised to become chair of the House Ways and Means Committee and obviously is an influential voice there. And there are other Republicans in the House that care about this issue and actually were working behind the scenes back when that Senate bill was passed to do something in the House, and it obviously didn't end up happening. That said, it does seem more likely that Republicans would break off pieces of immigration reform, like they've said they would do, and pass small bills at a time. That said, I do think it's true. I don't think that Senator McConnell or Speaker Boehner were lying when they say that if President Obama goes ahead and goes forward with executive action, it probably does, you know, quote unquote, poison the well. I see it as very unlikely that House Republicans are going to be willing to take up any serious immigration reform if President Obama is moving forward with his executive action, which the Republican base really, really dislikes.
Let's get a listener in here, Philip from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Philip. Welcome to On Point. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just had a comment about the outcome of the election. I think that if the Democratic Party is going to continue to run on more moderate or even conservative-leaning platforms, that it's no surprise that American voters will continue to opt for the real thing.
And vote Republican, you're saying?
Yes.
Philip, thank you. Mark is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I am one of the 66 million Americans that voted for President Obama 2 years ago, and I want him to honor that and serve out the remaining 2 years in opposition to everything these Republicans stand for. He got far more votes 2 years ago than either the Republican senators or the House got this time around. And if you think that the Republicans have any sincere desire to work with him, I would just point you to what they did in January 2009, when the Democrats controlled all three houses and the Republicans did nothing but oppose him. So I'd like to see him go ahead with executive action on immigration reform. The reason the Republicans are threatening him about that is because they know if he does it, it will cement a Democratic majority with Hispanic voters, and they're in fear of that.
Mark, thank you. Jack Beatty, what can President Obama do legally on immigration?
Well, we get a hint. According to the Wall Street Journal, the Department of Homeland Security has recently ordered more than 4 million green cards and visas for next year and says it might order another nearly 30 million for future years. Well, that's a big hint that that's what he's thinking of doing, extending some kind of pathway to citizenship and a green card pathway to undocumented workers in the United States, and to do it on the basis of his executive authority. Now, constitutionally, this is a debatable issue. Does he have that power? His lawyers say so. I'm sure others, I've read even scholars sympathetic to the Democrats who say, we're not so sure. But I think Mark is absolutely right. He's doing whatever the public policy issue. And by the way, we've dragged on for years with immigration in this, you know, tattered state with our laws in this state. But the imperative isn't so much a public policy as politics. This last election showed a creeping away of the Hispanic vote to Republicans. Some of these senators did as much as 20 points better than Mitt Romney
in 2012. And that certainly has got the president's attention. And so he's going to take this big risk. And, you know, one of the risks is that there will be rumblings, I'm sure there will be rumblings, at least, of impeachment, that this is exceeding his authority and that the House of Representatives will call him to account.
Hmm. Let's hear from Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. Here he is on Tuesday night on Fox News saying that the new Republican majority in the Senate should have a, quote, bold, positive, optimistic agenda for the country.
I hope come January, Republicans stand united. We stand as one, and we systematically, one after the other, vote on positive pro-growth ideas. We vote on tax reform. We vote on regulatory reform. We vote on embracing the American energy renaissance. We vote on going after and stopping Obamacare.
So, Nancy Cordes, there's Ted Cruz saying the Senate should focus on a lot of things. He's talking about repealing Obamacare, passing the Keystone Pipeline, securing the border. I mean, does Ted Cruz and the Tea Party wing of the party have enough support to push a more conservative agenda on these specific issues?
Well, I think the Senate is going to focus on Obamacare no matter what, not necessarily repealing the entire thing, but working on fixing the parts of it that Republicans think are most egregious. For example, repealing a medical device tax, which is a funding mechanism for Obamacare, which they think is very harmful to the industry. This is something that probably has enough Democratic support to pass in the Senate. Republicans are also very upset that they feel that companies are discouraged from keeping on full-time workers, 40-hour-a-week workers, because that will mean that they have to cover them. So that's something that they want to address. So I think what you'll likely see Senator McConnell do is, you know, sure, maybe he will kick off the Senate with a big vote on just repealing Obamacare, because that's a symbolic act that Republicans like to be able to take to send a message. But then he says he's going to focus on pieces, big pieces of the law that he thinks he can change, because after all, he does need some Democratic support to pass bills. Republicans are going to have 54 members of the Senate, but that's not enough when you've got a 60-vote threshold to pass major legislation.
Right. Let's go to Cyrus in Austin, Texas. Hi, Cyrus. Thanks for waiting. You're on Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. I just wanted to, you know, say I'm a supporter of the Democratic platform and the policies that Obama has tried unsuccessfully to put into to a law for the last four of the last 6 years. But I'm happy that we lost the Senate. I think if we had barely held on to the Senate, we would have a lame duck Senate, just Congress, just as a result of the continued Republican obstructionism. We're still going to have a lame duck Congress in the hands of the Republicans, because Obama is not going to do a lot of the things that they want to do. But at least now the, you know, mostly apathetic voters who don't really look at the details and just kind of put their finger in the wind and vote like they did in this election, will have, you know, have a really clear idea of what this, you know, these people stand for. If you look at the 111th Congress, which was the first 2 years of the Obama administration, it was one of the most productive Congress in five decades. A lot of stuff passed that people really like. And ever since then, it's been kind of all on Obama for, you know, the type of policies that he's tried to push through, and the Republicans have blocked. But now we'll get to see exactly what these folks stand for. And I think we'll see that it's definitely not in line with a lot of the polling numbers that your guests were.
Well, and perhaps about a Republican Congress to blame in the next couple of years, McKay Coppins.
You know, I you hear that sentiment a lot from both sides. It's, I have to say it's a pretty defeatist, you know, idea that, you know, hoping that this dysfunction and gridlock will continue so that whichever side that you're rooting for will eventually win. But yeah, of course. I mean, 2016, posturing and campaigning effectively started the day after the midterm election, and of course, what, you know, then the next 2 years are what happens in Congress is going to have a huge influence in 2016, both in the presidential campaign and in the various congressional races. I'm interested to see. I mean, I genuinely don't know. I'm interested to see what tack Republicans take. It does sound like Senator McConnell and Speaker Boehner want to get some things passed. But I was struck when I was reading their op-ed in the Wall Street Journal outlining their agenda that it wasn't, I mean, it was a partisan agenda, but it wasn't, you know, incredibly aggressive or radical the way that, you know, maybe some of the Tea Party initiatives could have been perceived out of 2010. They're talking about making some fairly modest reforms to the Affordable Care Act. They're talking about increasing charter schools. They're talking about tax reform. These are things that could probably get some Democratic support. I've always thought that President Obama, for all the talk about him being this radical ideologue that the right likes to say, I've always thought he was more of a pragmatist, and I've got to believe, you know, he has an option. He has 2 years left. Is he going to be the liberal stalwart warrior who spends his last 2 years fighting for liberal causes and taking a principled stand? Or is he going to want to get a lot of, you know, big things done, even if it means real compromises on his side? It'll be interesting to see what comes out of this next 2 years. I'm hopeful that the two sides actually can see an incentive to get together and really get some big things done.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Nancy Cordes, President Obama does not need to sign a Senate budget. What would a GOP budget look like? What will be their fiscal priorities to your mind? And how will they use the power of the purse to push legislation?
Well, their goal will be to cut the debt and deficit. Their goal will be to cut back on discretionary spending, social spending. They have also made it a goal to cut spending in entitlements, Social Security, and Medicare. Of course, these budgets are not binding, so they get taken more or less seriously every year, depending on who you are. You know, both parties make a big deal about their budget, especially the Republicans make a big deal of their budget and how much it cuts when they introduce it, and then they pass it and put it away, and nobody really ever talks about it again. So it's sort of one of these rallying cries that gets a lot of their partisans stirred up on both sides. But I think as a practical matter, it is a way to lay out your priorities, but nothing more.
Let's get another call in here, David in Woodbury, Connecticut. Hi, David. I'm trying to get you in here before the break. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Oh, hi, Jane, everybody. I'm very concerned about the Keystone oil pipeline running straight down through the breadbasket of our country, and it's a threat to the aquifer. And I encourage all listeners to contact our president, who has the final say-so, and encourage him to deny approval of the pipeline.
All right, David, thank you. Jack Beatty, how does the Keystone pipeline play into all this right now?
Well, I tell you, somebody who really cares about it, and that's Mary Landrieu, who's got a runoff coming up in, what, just a few weeks. She's in favor of it. That's her big, she really sort of, you know, has been saying to Louisianans, I'm going to get this. If the president could decide this in that time, it would help her in that election. Beyond that, you know, although it's clearly a resonant symbolic issue, when you compare, Keystone, the amount of energy and carbon that Keystone pipeline would add to the climate versus what President Obama's EPA regulations will take away, there's no comparison. The EPA regulations are major developments in climate change. Mm-hmm. Keystone, no.
Nancy Cordes, as we head into break here, talk about the mood of this country. This is a deeply pessimistic electorate. Pick your poll. I'm looking at one here. 7 out of 10 Americans describe the economy as not good or poor. 8 out of 10 worry the direction of the economy, about where it's going in the next year. How do you see it?
And I think this election only contributed to that because so many of the messages, the 2.2 million ads that people watched, were incredibly negative and left them with a real sour taste about both parties. But I think the biggest damper is the fact that people feel that their wages, their pocketbook has not changed, even though the economy seems to bounce back. And for the first time in our exit polls, we found that more Americans felt that the economy would not be as good for their children as it had been for them.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, NPR's beloved Car Talk host, Tom Magliazzi, died on Monday at the age of 77. Here is Tom with his brother, Ray.
Amazingly enough, you prove that even in a case where one person might know nothing about a subject, it is possible for two people
to know less
to
than
know
nothing.
Even less.
He will be missed. Jon Stewart told CNN's Christiane Amanpour that he did not vote Tuesday in the midterm elections. Later, he apologized and said he was joking, but a lot of viewers thought he was very serious.
We are talking as Americans go to an election, the midterms right here today. Did
yes.
you vote?
No.
No?
No, I just moved. I don't even know where my thing is now.
And Taylor Swift's album 1989 sold over a million copies in its first week, the largest sales week of any album since 2002. Here's the hit single, Shake It Off. You can join the conversation, listeners. Do you want the Supreme Court to take up gay marriage? Do the new jobs numbers square with what's happening where you live? We're joined by McKay Coppins from BuzzFeed, Nancy Cordes from CBS News, and our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Let's get more callers in here. Stephen in Savannah, Georgia is on the line. Stephen, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much. I just had one comment. We were grateful in Georgia that we have a Republican governor reelected because at least we do have some fiscal responsibility. To me, it blows my mind that the federal government can operate without a budget. Me as a business owner with employees, if we didn't have a budget, we wouldn't know where we were. To me, that is just crazy that we have not had a budget for the federal government. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Mm. Jack Beatty, Nancy Cordes, McKay Coppins.
Well, you know, there has been a budget, a continuing resolution, they call it, which essentially continues what they did the year before. It isn't as if the government is just, spending money, borrowing money willy-nilly. It's borrowing according to the legislative authority laid down in the continuing resolution. So there is that check on spending.
Nancy Cordes, President Obama says he's going to seek congressional backing for U.S. attacks on ISIS. I'm curious what the mood is up on Capitol Hill. Will he get it?
I think that he will. I think that both sides see ISIS as a current and continuing threat. I think that they were very clear that they wanted to be consulted and will appreciate the fact that they are being consulted. Frankly, their focus, not everyone's, but most of their focus has been elsewhere for the past couple of months because they've all been home in their districts campaigning, and they're, you know, now going to be coming back to Washington and kind of getting back to speed on the issue. But he got enough support for arming the rebels in Syria and training them that I think he will, you know, not have a difficult time getting support for this as well. Although members from the right and the left are going to want a lot of specifics about exactly how long this mission would take, what it would entail, how much it would cost. These are details that the White House has been either unwilling or unable to provide up until this point, but that are going to leave a lot of members uncomfortable if they don't get some more specifics.
Mm. Also, McKay Coppins, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait are discussing the creation of a military pact, so to speak, to fight ISIS. The significance of that to your mind?
Well, you know, I was going to just piggybacking off the last comment. I think that one of the interesting subplots to follow going forward, and this has to do with a lot of the foreign policy issues that that Congress is going to have to face, is that this ongoing internal debate within the Republican Party over national security and foreign policy, with Rand Paul representing a sort of what he calls conservative realism or non-interventionist policy, and then many Republicans like John McCain representing a more traditional neoconservative approach. The hawks, as it were, in Congress gained a few advocates in the Senate, in Joni Ernst and Tom Cotton. And so it'll be interesting to see how the Republicans in Congress in this coming year take on these threats like ISIS and other foreign policy issues. For a while, it seemed like we were having what a lot of pundits called a libertarian moment, or an isolationist moment in foreign policy, with Rand Paul gaining a lot of support for scaling back the United States' involvement in various foreign conflicts. But it does seem like maybe there's a case to be made that the tide has started to turn back the other way. That'll certainly be an important issue in the coming year in Congress and in the Republican primaries in 2016.
Hmm. Let me move to the same-sex marriage movement for a moment here. It lost its first major case in a federal appeals court ruling this week after a lengthy string of victories. This certainly creates a split among the nation's circuit courts. Here's some sound after the Sixth Circuit ruling to uphold laws against gay marriage in Ohio, Michigan, Kentucky, Tennessee. Here's lawyer Dana Nesser, who represents gay couples in the Michigan court case, speaking at a press conference.
I can say absolutely 100% that we intend to appeal our case to the United States Supreme Court.
Nancy Cordes, does this virtually guarantee a Supreme Court review?
I think it doesn't guarantee one, but I think it's highly possible, and I think it's a sign that, you know, as these states continue to pass laws, they're a little different everywhere, that this is going to continue to be an issue, not just for the Supreme Court, but also for Congress, because there's an ongoing debate over whether this is something that should be handled at the national level or at the state level.
Jack, how do you see this?
Oh, the odds are very strong that it's going to go to the court, and the key vote there is going to be Anthony Kennedy, who in prior decisions sort of opened the door to what's been happening, and his libertarianism there, I think, is going to, well, we don't know, but I think court watchers who favor gay marriage are expecting that he will vote with them.
Let me move to the U.S. jobs report just out. The U.S. added 214,000 jobs, unemployment falling to 5.8%. McKay Coppins, how do you see these new numbers?
I mean, I think that a lot of people, you know, the experts, the economic experts that I follow all said that this was basically good news. There were also indications that applications for unemployment have dropped off to new lows, and it seems like the economy is getting better. I mean, I think that it's been brought up, but it's worth repeating that every exit poll that we saw throughout the country on Tuesday showed that the economy was by far the most important issue that people cared about. And while we continue to see unemployment dropping, what I think a lot of voters need to see and are wanting to see, and that's what's showing up in the polls and in the election results, is they want to see an increase in their take-home pay. They want to see, a little bit more, they want better jobs. They want to see a little bit more wiggle room in their house budgets. And so, it's always hard to follow these reports and say, well, the economy is getting better and everything is getting better for people, because it really depends on where you are in the country. It depends on what sector you're in, what industry you're in. And Wall Street also has been having a really great run over the past year, but that hasn't necessarily trickled down to the average Main Street voter. And I think that we'll continue to see that play out in Congress and in elections until we see serious economic recovery.
Well, and to McKay's point, Nancy Cordes, a lot of the new jobs are lower wage jobs.
That's right. And, or people are finding that they're part-time jobs or 30-hour-a-week jobs. And it's not only that they feel that their wages aren't going up, they also feel that college is getting more expensive, that they're paying back student loans, that their kids are having a hard time getting a job, so their kids are living with them longer. All of those things are combining to make people feel that they are worse off than they were 5 or 10 years ago.
Mm. I want to move on here to a difficult story reported this week. More than 600 American service members since 2003 have now reported to military medical staff members that they believe they were exposed to chemical warfare agents in Iraq. The Pentagon a bit under fire here for not recognizing the scope of this or offering adequate treatment to the injured, Jack Beatty.
Oh, yes. This is just, you know, it was clearly a cover-up. I mean, that's what a cover-up, because they didn't want, that is, the Bush administration did not want it to come out that, yes, weapons of mass destruction had been found, but they weren't the weapons that we invaded Iraq for, to eliminate. They were weapons that had been accumulated from, the late 80s and early 90s. And so it was hushed up. And there wasn't, the military did not take care to protect the health of the servicemen who were handling it. It's a callous sort of coda to the Iraq war.
Nancy Cordes, how's this story playing on Capitol Hill?
Well, I think it's going to cause a lot of anger. I mean, I think when members come back next week, and they'll only be here for about a week and a half before they leave again for the Thanksgiving break, they're going to have a lot of questions about that. And they're already lining up hearings with military officials, not just about that issue, but also about Ebola and how we're handling that. So I think that there's going to be, you know, it's something that both sides are going to be talking about.
Moving to Ebola, since you mentioned it, Nancy, here's some sound from the University of Ottawa international law professor Amir Attaran saying in an interview with CBC News on Saturday that he strongly disagrees with Canada's new Ebola travel ban, which includes medical workers going to help Ebola patients.
There is a fire burning in West Africa right now. And we are taking vengeance against the firefighters. That's what we're doing. And if you think that makes it safer, boy, are you ever wrong.
Nancy Cordes, do you see political support for a travel ban?
There is a great deal of support for a travel ban, especially on the Republican side. Not enough, I don't think, at this point to lead to legislation. But certainly there are a number of members who have been in these hearings who are questioning why we are allowing anybody from the Ebola zone to come into the country, or why we're not restricting their movements in some way, or quarantining them, or tracking them. So that's an argument that has been made. And the White House and the CDC have pushed back pretty forcefully on that and said, look, we would have a more difficult time tracking people who come here from West Africa if they felt that they were being stigmatized. They wouldn't admit where they were coming from. They wouldn't be reporting back to us with their temperature. It would cause people to go underground, and as you heard in that clip you just played, it would be stigmatizing people who are going over there to sort of combat Ebola at the source, which in the end is the way that we're going to keep Americans safe, is by stamping out the disease where it started in West Africa.
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Let's go to Tom in Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Tom. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. I think it's absolutely ridiculous that I'm a big fan of the Obama administration, but I think the one place where they dropped the ball is in not imposing travel bans to and from those three African countries. Let's take a real quick example. Let's say you've got a leper colony. It's filled with leprosy. You're going to allow people to travel in and out of that colony without any restrictions whatsoever, and it's even a very soft example, because leprosy has a cure. Ebola has no cure. This is a fatal disease, and so let me get this straight. We're going to allow people to travel in and out from those countries, and once an epidemic like this takes hold, it exponentially multiplies. I don't think the CDC, the WHO, or the administration can effectively contain it.
Tom, thank you. Thank you, McKay Coppins. Let me get you in here. Our closest allies, Canada, Australia, have both imposed travel bans. Is this something you think may happen in the U.S.?
It's certainly possible. I mean, the argument against the caller's point is that the U.S. could implement travel bans from West African countries, but they can't implement travel bans for all West Africans, right? So it's entirely possible that somebody from a West African country could travel to a European country and then fly into the U.S. I mean, it's very difficult to say that nobody from these countries is allowed to come into the United States. It's just hard to track. The problem with this whole issue is that we're dealing with what is essentially the politics of fear, and I don't think that
it's necessarily deliberate on anyone's part. I don't think anyone's trying to stoke fear, but there's a lot of fear when you look at, when you watch the news, you see what's happening in West Africa. There's a lot of people that are afraid of a similar outbreak in the United States. And so politicians, you know, say what they think these voters want to hear, and a lot of them probably really believe it. But there are these competing impulses of, you know, pragmatic, fending for ourselves, taking care of ourselves, and then the humanity of thinking, you know, we want more doctors and medical professionals in West Africa to take care of the outbreak there. And so that's really what's going on.
Jack Beatty, in our last minute or so here, you wanted to talk quickly about a story in Britain coming out of the UK this week.
Well, just briefly, the head of the Britain's NSA is accusing the U.S. tech companies of, quote, being facilitators of terrorism. Their reaction to the Snowden revelations was to, you know, tighten up on encryption and make it harder to for governments to find out what's going on the internet and so on. And the Britain's NSA guy says, this is really helping terrorists.
Well, many thanks to a great panel today. Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. Nancy, always good to talk with you. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me on.
McKay Coppin, senior political writer for BuzzFeed News. McKay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, listeners, we end this hour with heavy hearts and a lot of love. Many of you know that Tom Ashbrook has lost his wife, Danielle, after a long battle with cancer. Jack, I know you have a few words you wanted to say at this point.
Yes, Danielle and Tom met as teenagers, and together they shared what Tom calls 42 years of perfect love, a gift shared with their children, Ben, Dylan, and Lauren, with friends on three continents, with us, Tom's On Point family, and with you, the community of Tom's listeners. That gift infuses Tom's boundless imaginative empathy and passion for life. We shared in his great gift. Now we all share in his great loss. We hurt for our colleague and friend. To Tom and his family, we extend our deepest sympathies and, in a return of his gift, send our love.
And I know Tom is so grateful for the tremendous outpouring he's received from so many listeners. Tom, we send our love to you and your family at this very difficult time. Our thoughts are with you, my friend. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.